Here's one way to think about America's future in this century. The majority of babies being born right now in the United States are of color. They're Hispanic, Black, Asian, Native American, mixed race. And Donald Trump's tenure as president is not likely to change that, no matter what the white supremacists among his supporters may hope. The question is, what will he do as president of all Americans to help kids of color get a good education and have ample opportunity to come up through the ranks, adding their ideas and energy to an economy that is increasingly knowledge-based? If the answer is not much, or worse, be concerned, because America will not benefit as a global leader or as a society from holding back the potential of half of its future workforce. And, of course, some non-white Americans have a harder time breaking the color barrier than others, especially in cutting-edge fields. African Americans, in 2011, made up 11% of the total workforce, pretty close to their actual share of total population. But they only made up 6% of STEM workers. That's STEM as in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, the areas where innovations that change lives often happen. And the more diversity there is among people coming up with those kinds of innovations, the more likely they'll address the needs and challenges of diverse communities, not just of the middle class and affluent white guys. So, as our nation's first Black president winds down his two-term tenure with majority approval at home on multiple opinion polls and renewed respect for America abroad, as a foreign correspondent during most of the Obama presidency, I've seen it. The question turns to how to help more African Americans become changemakers and leaders at home. How to make sure that as the 21st century progresses, America continues to show the world that its great strength of being empowering and inclusive is not in the dustbin of history. This is Whose Century Is It? A podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. Let me start with a story about one young man who has a thing or two in common with President Obama. Joshua Johnson is 18 years old. He's smart, thoughtful, well-spoken. I met him in the summer at the University of Michigan, where he was attending a summer prep course before launching into his freshman year, already with ambitious plans for his future.
I really want to make software that makes the user interface for coding a lot easier for people, so that people don't really have to go to school and study coding and all this to make a career out of it, but instead can kind of, you know, do Khan Academy courses and things like that and grasp the idea of coding a lot easier than we do now. Like, make programming available for everybody, you know? And then that'll, like, change the world. And once everyone programs, everyone is able to contribute their ideas and we can accomplish so much more.
Kind of makes you smile, right? The idealism, the drive, the vision, and you hope it long continues. But there are more layers to this than just a young, smart guy studying computer engineering at one of the nation's top schools. Joshua Johnson grew up on the south side of Chicago in a neighborhood rife with gangs.
The neighborhood that I live in Chicago, it's like colloquially known as Killer Ward, and it's got a huge gang presence that kind of drags kids in pretty early. I knew kids in like the 7th, 8th grade who were pretty involved in gangs. And I think, yeah, a lot of great potential was kind of lost to that.
They try to get you to join too?
No. No.
They kind of knew from early on that you were going to be doing something different.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Joshua was different, smart for sure, but also, like President Obama, half white. His parents separated during his childhood. His dad, who's white, works for a bank. His mom, who's Black, is a social worker with the Workers Center for Racial Justice.
Yeah, she teaches workshops on, like, how to respond to, if you see someone shot on the street, how to do, like, trauma.
First aid?
Yeah, exactly.
In Joshua's neighborhood, Englewood, that skill is all too useful. There have been 53 homicides there in the past year, in 3 square miles, with 30,000 people. Almost all the residents are African American. 1 out of 5 adults there is unemployed, and half the families who live there fall beneath the poverty line. This is where some people, too many people, are quick to say, it's because they're lazy, or it's their own fault. It's Black gang culture that keeps people down. I'm not going to have time in this podcast to untangle all the systemic and historical reasons why such dismissive comments are simplistic and grossly unfair, or why it's so much more likely that an African American born into the lowest 25% by income in the United States is unlikely to rise above it compared to white Americans. But it is safe to say that systemically entrenched racism has something to do with it.
A lot of the public schools in Chicago have really, really harsh rules, and they'll have really hard penalties for them. Kids will get like suspended or even expelled from their schools for doing things like fighting. And I think that the way that we treat our kids in our community kind of pushes them away from the pathway instead of encouraging them. And I think that really needs to change. There definitely could be a lot more programs available to them that kind of inspire them to do things. So bringing a lot of the successful minority engineers back into the community to show the kids that this isn't an impossible thing to do.
So the friends in your neighborhood who you grew up with, what do they think of what you're doing?
They're definitely proud of me. I just wish we did like go to different high schools, because they kind of stayed in their local high school, and I went to the magnet school I talked about. From that point, it was kind of the division of the like our pathways that we went to. But from grammar school, they've always kind of looked up to me, and I've looked up to them for like different reasons. And I was really close to my like friends in grammar school and friends from my community, and I just feel like they saw some what I was doing was like impossible to them or something that they couldn't accomplish. And I always try to tell them that this isn't something that they can't do, that could like all get here to this point where I'm at. Yeah, I just feel like if we can get some way to have those kids recognize that, then success in poor communities and minority communities will be like way higher.
And sure, sometimes someone like Joshua can study hard, rise above it, and become, as he has, the first person in his family to go to college.
My mom has never gone to college, but she, since I was born, she always like saw it as something that I had to do. Like, I didn't really have a choice. It was an expectation from her.
And now, here he is at the University of Michigan, brought in by his own ability, but also by a real effort being made here and beyond to pull more African Americans into science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM. That's the mission now of Robert Scott, a towering, genial force of nature who knows from his own experience how much family support early in life matters.
My grandmother, I had an aunt who was the matriarch of my family that kind of ruled the entire Scott siblings, certainly my mother. Yes, my grandmother. I actually had a counselor in high school, Miss Juanita Goodwin, who was an African-American woman who insisted that I prepare myself for college. And on more than one occasion, when I would bring in my elective sheet, she would tear it up and say, no, you're not taking shop and you're not taking speech and writing. You're taking a college prep math, and you're taking college prep chemistry and physics, and take this sheet home and have your mother sign it.
Robert Scott got his degree here in electrical and computer engineering, went off and had a career at Procter & Gamble, retired as a senior executive, and then the University of Michigan asked him to come back and get more African Americans into the STEM pipeline. In the week I was visiting, in July 2016, Robert Scott talked to an auditorium full of visiting high school students and rising college freshmen at a time when there'd been multiple shootings of unarmed black men and some shootings of police by black men.
I'm Robert Scott. I'll formally introduce myself, but you all know me as Grandpa. That's right. And I'm sort of here as Grandpa today. I'm here to talk about a really important subject.
And that is what he calls being a multicultural leader. It's important, he says, because everyone has multiple identities, and anyone can fall victim to overlooking that and just seeing what's obvious, just stereotyping. A cop sees a black guy with dreadlocks in an old car and shoots him, even though the guy in the car is a gentle guy who works in a nursery school. Or a black guy in Dallas, a former soldier angry about unarmed black guys getting shot by cops, shoots police in a police force run by an African-American who encourages nonviolent community policing. Those are the kinds of stereotypes Robert Scott is urging these kids to look beyond.
You've been socialized by definition. It's not a bad thing. That's just the way it is. The question is, how have you been socialized? And do you know? And can you move that socialization from unconscious to conscious so that you know how you think, and then learn how to talk and engage with others to hear how they've been socialized, and based on that, what do they think and believe? Seeking first to understand and then to be understood. That's how you have constructive dialogue. Let me say right up front, for those of you who think that Grandpa's a naive old fool, this ain't easy. If it was easy, this crap wouldn't be happening. And it's been happening for centuries, okay? So, not to despair. It's our responsibility to work to change this.
Robert Scott has been working on change for a long time, including as a student here. He says he didn't encounter much overt racism back in the 1970s, but there were times.
Well, so in my chemistry course, I got my first exam back, and looking at the exam, I noticed that the scores were added up wrong. You got points for all the questions, you add them up. It totaled to be like 86. For some reason, it was added up to 76. The second exam came back. The scores were added up wrong, low. The third exam, the scores were added up wrong. The final exam was not posted. I had to come back to school to get my final exam and grade posted. Now, I wouldn't have seen it then as a microaggression, but for a chemistry professor to add up scores wrong four times, twice maybe, three times is enemy action. And so I believe there were microaggressions then, just like there are microaggressions now. You just had to kind of roll up and deal with it.
So what'd you do?
So I learned to assume the worst and to prepare myself. My 4 years at the University of Michigan were the best years and the worst years of my life simultaneously, because it was constant. It was invigorating, and the friends I made and what I learned and the capabilities I got here. My employers at Procter & Gamble told me I was one of the best prepared engineers to ever come in P&G. That was Michigan that did that. Oh. But it was long, hard, painful, hand-to-hand combat. And so part of what I do now is I have to teach resilience. You get punched, you get up. You don't get punched and stay down. It would have been very easy to just say, I give up, stay down. I'm not getting up again, but that's not what you do.
Does it surprise you that there's still as much punching, as it were, these days as there is?
I'm sad to say that there is, and it does surprise me. I had hoped that by now we would have turned a corner. In some respects, we have. I think things are more subtle now. I don't think things are so blatant as, you're too dumb to add, and therefore I can misadd your score and you'll never catch it. I think now people say things because they don't realize it's hurtful, or they don't care, or they make the assumption that it's a level playing field when it's not, and therefore they won't lend the helping hand or give extra time or whatever. And realizing that that's every bit as challenging and as hurtful to people as misadding up scores.
And something else that's a little painful? When Robert was a student at the University of Michigan, about 5% of the student body was African-American. And now?
It's about 7%, but the devil's in the details there. It's 7% underrepresented. So that's African-American plus Hispanic plus Native American. And in those numbers is an increase in the Hispanic population offset by a decrease in the African-American population.
A decrease?
A decrease.
This going backward thing, it's bigger than just the number of African Americans at the University of Michigan or at any single university. Just in terms of basic income, African American families around the country are making less on average than they did 15 years ago, and also less as a percentage of what white households earn. Fewer than half of black households own their own home, compared to almost three quarters of whites. And while the number of African Americans with college and advanced degrees has grown, it hasn't grown as fast as white Americans getting the same degrees. Interesting, then, that during this election we heard all about angry white people, and not so much about angry black people. Although it certainly seems there's plenty to be angry about, or at least frustrated. Robert Scott and a whole network of people with whom he works, in Michigan and around the country, are trying mightily to bend the curve so African Americans do better in general and are better represented among innovators coming up with the ideas and technologies that will shape the future.
We no longer live in a manufacturing economy. We live in a knowledge economy. And the preparation for being a knowledge worker, to me, equates to STEM. I mean, I can't say it any more succinctly than that. If you look at where the jobs are, where the opportunities are, where the exciting careers are, I believe in equifinality. There's lots of different ways to the same endpoint. But I think it's critically important for African American and women to identify and aspire to top schools in STEM because it's the way the world is going.
When you're ready, go.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming out today. My name is Noah Tutt. I'm from Hudsonville, Michigan.
My name is Lindsay Endek. I'm from Jupiter, Florida.
My name is Mia Watkins, and I'm from Ann Arbor.
These high school students, black and white, are part of a summer camp program at the University of Michigan in engineering. It's aimed at lighting a fire of interest that might just propel them into careers, coming up with cool ideas to solve big global problems. This group is rehearsing a presentation it will give on a proposal to help reduce flooding in Houston. And then there's Janavi Imam, who's 16, and is on a team that came up with a novel way to catch and destroy viruses early.
This is kind of like a tube, and this is the entryway for the blood. So the blood is going to flow through, and we have this gel that is coated with antibodies. And so the antibodies are going to attract the viruses, so the viruses are going to stick to the gel. And then we also have a transducer that releases sound waves, and that is used to determine the shape and the size of the virus molecule to make sure it is a virus and it's not a red blood cell.
And then the transducer sends signals to enzymes, which eat through the protective walls of the virus and stop it from reproducing. Pretty cool. One of the teachers here is Ariel Murphy, a PhD student in material engineering. She loves to see female African-American students drawn to this kind of research. When she was an undergraduate at the University of Alabama, she was one of just two African-American women in material engineering.
A lot of it is just like early exposure, right? I'm from the South, so there's a heavy population of African-Americans in the South. Most of the schools that are heavy in African-American population, they lack the resources. So they lack the opportunities to even have access to the types of classes that would prepare you for engineering.
So what got you through?
What really helped me a lot of it was it always starts with the teacher. So in high school, most of my family members are educators. I have a couple of male cousins that are engineers. But I had a teacher in high school that recognized that I was pretty good at math and science, and she encouraged me to compete in science fair. And so I got really competitive in it and started doing college-level research as a sophomore in high school. And just having that early exposure and then kind of also having allies. So I did my research at the University of Alabama as a high school student. And so I already had allies there. And when I got there, it was like being at home. You know, professors knew me, my department head knew me, and I was blessed enough to actually have an African-American woman as a department head. And now she's a dean there.
You got, you know, the two things going. You're both female and African-American. I mean, do you feel like it's improving compared to what, you know, your experience was growing up, or are things kind of static? Or
I think that's a very hard question, improving. So, no, I don't think it's improving. And if you look at the statistics, it will show you that it's not improving for African Americans at all. It's actually, it's declining the amount that are in STEM, and the Latino population is rising. And I think a lot of it just goes back to there's just a lack. I think in material science, I was just reading an article that said only 2% of the faculty are African American women. So when you don't see someone that looks like you, you just don't think you can do it. For African American, especially women, you don't have a lot of allies in industry, whereas your white counterparts would, right? They have people that are coming to the career fairs that look like them, and, you know, or they have family members that are presidents and CEOs of different companies, and so they're just the chain. They're just helping them move up, which is very different for like an African American woman. You almost kind of have to find your own way and make your own path, and that can be a little difficult. So just, I think it really starts at the like K through 12 level, and then just more of the professional development in the undergrad and graduate level.
And kids' conceptions of who they are and what they can do start forming early, way early. Some teachers say you've got to get to them before they're 8, before they start getting pulled into bad habits, into settling for less than realizing their real potential. Ariel tries to help on that front too, in the Detroit Area Pre-College Engineering Program, or DAPSEP. It starts with grade school students and works up from there. Jason Lee is its executive director.
So DAPSUP is a 40-year-old nonprofit organization located in the city of Detroit, and our mission is to increase the number of historically underrepresented students who are academically prepared and motivated to pursue STEM fields: science, technology, engineering, mathematics. And a couple years ago, we added another M to the acronym STEM for medicine because of the significance of the medical community in Detroit and Southeast Michigan. I'm a graduate of the University of Michigan. I came here for graduate school in engineering. And I noticed that many of the students who were in my peer group or undergrads here or associated with the National Society of Black Engineers, many of them came from Detroit, and many of them participated in DAPSUP. I call it a rites of passage for many young people to pursue STEM fields. As a parent, if your child had an interest in robotics or medicine or going to college or engineering or physics or any of those fields, many of the parents would say, well, why don't we put you in DAPSUP? I used to work at Ford Motor Company, and many of my peers who were from Detroit participated in the program. Their children are now participating in the DAPSUP program because it was such a significant impact in their lives.
Are there any particular challenges the program is facing at the moment?
Wow. Okay, yes.
Detroit is about an hour's drive from Ann Arbor, and it's got a thing or two in common with Joshua Johnson's neighborhood of Inglewood in the south side of Chicago. It long had the highest murder rate in the country. Now St. Louis has surpassed it. The population of Detroit is a third what it was at its peak. Same with the neighborhood of Inglewood. Both are overwhelmingly African American. And in both, the school system is less of a springboard for kids than a sinkhole.
Historically, DAPSUP has had a strong relationship with Detroit Public Schools. Over recent years, charter schools have had a significant influx within the city. We have the highest concentration of charter schools in Detroit compared to any other municipality in the state of Michigan. There's some disadvantages to that. When it comes to communicating opportunities to kids, it used to be a one-stop shop. I could send the information through Detroit Public Schools, and the information is communicated to the students that way. However, now, if every charter school in Michigan being its own district, then you have to go to every one of the schools or districts or charter management companies to engage and identify talented students.
And the record of the Detroit school system is worth paying attention to, because Donald Trump's pick for education secretary, billionaire Betsy DeVos, lobbied to make it what it is. This is her speaking at this year's American Federation for Children Policy Summit.
Every child in America deserves access to a world-class education. The problem is, and we all know this, the system is broken and too many children are missing out. And school choice is the pathway for millions of children to get the education they deserve.
So Betsy DeVos's goal is to take more taxpayers' dollars from public schools and give them via vouchers to charter, private, and religious schools. That, of course, hurts public schools. And the Detroit public school system is already hurting. The schools have lost two-thirds of their students over the past 15 years, and the system is deeply in debt thanks to inadequate state funding. Many public schools have closed. For those that are still open, test scores in math and English are among the worst in the country. Want to hear what it's like teaching in one of those places? Ask Hans Sauter. He taught in the Detroit public school system for years. Now he's at the University of Michigan, and I caught up with him when he was walking between one thing and another.
We would celebrate when there was a box of paper towels that would come in. I mean, that was the only item that really came in new. Other than that, the way I became good at what I did is late night going into back stock rooms and finding out what needs to be liberated and finding all these toys from decades prior and just bringing them out. You know, sometimes I had permission, sometimes I didn't, but at the end of the day, taxpayers bought that stuff for the kids. Right, so they can learn. Why is it sitting back in a closet? And I know that that, unfortunately, is something that I think happens around the district. Now, this is, you know, almost 20 years later, so a lot of those things probably are broken down and need to be replaced. But I would bet a couple dollars that it hasn't been replaced.
Hans Sauter eventually left the Detroit public school system and went to work in a nearby town called Ypsilanti. While he was there, he was named Michigan Science Teacher of the Year.
And I remember leaving from Detroit and going to Ypsilanti, and in Detroit we shared this cart full of 30 microscopes. Pretty decent microscopes. Got up to 400X, but you had to check it out. so that other teachers could use it and stuff like that. And that was fine. We had a system. It worked. You get to Ipsy, which isn't a terribly affluent district, but much better than Detroit. Every teacher had their own set. That just typifies the supply piece in Detroit. And then, you know, there's truancy and just kids carry baggage. You know, baggage of loneliness, baggage of, you know, not really knowing what the future holds. When you're talking to a kid and trying to tell them about the cell or trying to bring them through some neat biochemical process, and they're just trying to figure out, am I going to eat tonight? You know, there's just no way that you're going to be able to get to that depth that you need to so that the kids are prepared to come to this level, unless some radical changes occur.
Like what?
Gosh. I would hope it would start at the family level. You can't legislate the family. So the solution, the solution is that every single student has their own teacher. And that's not going to happen, right? I had 32 in my school, 17 showed on an average day in DPS. Some of them constant, some of them kind of in and out.
DPS is?
Detroit Public Schools. Because I might go a couple days and I don't get a chance to encourage Jimmy, and next thing he's gone for 2-3 days. And then he comes back and he's, you know, we're in the middle of something that he has no idea, he has no context, he has no prior knowledge about. And so he sits and try to wade through it, and then he disappears again. So you see that at a lot of schools. I wouldn't say so much at affluent schools, but at schools with that are under-resourced. I love teaching, but they were just hammering us with pay cuts and things like that. Uh-huh. I've always thought that a teacher that leaves a classroom is kind of a cop-out, but I found this job here. So I work at the Center for Engineering Diversity and Outreach. My title is called an Academic Program Officer, and basically what I tell folks is that I design curriculum and activities around engineering for middle and high school kids, and primarily our focus is schools that have populations of students that have been historically underrepresented in engineering.
So he still sees Detroit school kids. He just hosts them here and encourages them to study hard and dream big. So does his colleague Nick Collins, who directs the University of Michigan Center for Educational Outreach.
It's not an easy task, in part because there's so many obstacles. I think some of the obstacles, a large part of them, are economic. If you look at data, recently reported data, by the way, it suggests that of the students who attend the most prestigious colleges and universities in the country, 72% of them come from the upper economic strata, that is, families that are in the upper 25%, while only 3% of students at our most selective colleges come from the lower economic strata, that is, the bottom 25%. That kind of inequality is troubling.
There are some people in Detroit and perhaps in some of the other cities that are having problems with their school systems, particularly Detroit, that suspect that there's something else going on in addition to just trying to save money within the school system, that this is, you know, basically locking in a generation into an underclass, and that parents will eventually leave and go to schools elsewhere, and that will free up property for gentrification.
There are people who believe that. There are people in Detroit or in Flint who believe that decisions that have been made purposefully to support regentrification by a different form of urban renewal, that is, moving people out of central cities elsewhere. Whether this is something that's really at work or whether that is something that is simply opportunist, that is, people taking advantage of a situation and using their income, is another question.
Yeah, I mean, it just, when you look at some of the recent laws and actions by the government in the state of Michigan, the mind boggles. You know, you've got the water that's toxic in Flint. You've got new regulations that allow schools to hire teachers who aren't qualified and not even to be able to pay a premium to teachers who are exceptionally qualified. I mean, it almost seems like they're going out of their way to set certain communities up to fail.
Well, our legislature did, in fact, pass a recent law creating a Detroit Community School District. The old school district will now be responsible solely for paying off the previous debt of the Detroit Public Schools. And in passing the law, they also indicated that people who are not certified as teachers are to be allowed to be hired as teachers. And at the same time, number of degrees earned, years of experience as a teacher cannot be taken into consideration when determining salaries. I'm not sure what the legislature was thinking when they passed those laws, but it is a fact that that's what happened.
You start to get a sense of why Detroit has some of the worst outcomes of any school system in the country, though variations of it exist in different places around the country. But for all these problems, and they may get worse in places like Detroit before they get better, there are efforts to try to pull the next generation of African Americans up, all the way up into senior management and top leadership, and have a little fun along the way.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. I got 5 minutes to get you motivated, highly pumped up, excited, and your adrenaline flowing.
This is a gathering of a couple hundred African-American business executives, part of a group called the Information Technology Senior Management Forum. They've been around for 20 years, and their goal is to support each other, mentor new generations of African-American executives, and get more African-Americans into the C-suite, top leadership positions in companies doing cutting-edge innovation. That's starting to happen. Over the past 20 years, the percentage of African-Americans in C-suite positions has doubled from 3% to 6%. That's still less than half the percentage of African-Americans in the general population. So, what still needs to happen? I talked with ITSMF's chairperson, Carla Ogunrinde, who worked for years in technology in Fortune 100 companies and is now a leadership coach. She says some recent visits she's taken to Silicon Valley have gotten her thinking.
So anytime you can bring your experiences that look, sound differently into a conversation, it becomes interesting immediately. Ideas are boundless. And, you know, being at Silicon Valley and where ideas are king, you get to talk about them almost as a philosophical topic, requires a bit of courage. But it's that openness to say, well, what about, and what if, and how about, and there isn't any specific answer. And I started to think about what it would take for an African-American leader to thrive in a space that way. So I'm not speaking digital natives at this point, right? Because digital natives, I think, is a bit different. They've been exposed to ideas being king and, yeah, and to the world. But for someone at ITSMF, who's been part of ITSMF, I think would find it to be a challenge.
Why is that?
It's almost sacrilegious to say that, because we nurtured people to lead, to simply be leaders feeling supported. And we do that really, really well. I think it would be a challenge only because of what has been traditional versus not only non-traditional, but without any rules, without any boundaries. And I think the boundaries and the rules has provided a level of safety. If you do these 10 things, look this way, wear this suit, speak, you know, use these words, you'll be okay. And in Silicon Valley, there aren't any rules. And that can feel chaotic, but ideas grow in chaos because you never know how one will grow from the other. And just watching some of the conversations and being part of some of the conversations, what you first have to shed is trying to know and instead replace it with curiosity, mm-hmm, just boundless curiosity.
What was your own experience?
The moment it became easy is the moment I recognized that having the microphone and being the different person in the room meant that people would listen. Not necessarily agree with me, but that they would listen because they were curious to know what I would say. And that used to be incredibly intimidating because you want to say something of importance. You want to say something smart. You want to say something that shows that you should be there.
The president of this group is a woman, too. Viola Thompson, and she gives due credit to her white male colleagues at Ernst & Young with helping her rise and becoming the first female African-American partner there 20 years ago.
So the challenges didn't stop, right? I made it to partner, that's great. But there's still like this really, really high bar of expectation. And there weren't a lot of people that I could go to who look like me, right? That I could kind of share, here's what I'm struggling with. And especially in an environment where it's always about, what have you done for me lately? And a lot of times there's collaboration that's done, and those partners come together and work on projects. But because I didn't look like them, and I was a female, didn't always get invited to that table to work on this $30, $40, $50 million project, which then later I would be judged on during the evaluation process. So within ITSMF, they helped me understand how to navigate around that. And they also created an environment for me to just know that I wasn't alone.
What difference do you think it's made for what you're trying to do that we've had an African-American president?
So from an inspiration standpoint, I think it's made a huge difference. People can literally say, oh my God, we had a black president of the United States. There isn't anything that I can't do. I mean, that job held by a black man, amazing, right? At the same time, I think it has perhaps caused some people to question what are going to be the expectations now going forward.
How so?
You've had this black president, so what are you guys complaining about? You know, so sit down and be quiet. You know, you've had your black president now. It's okay. We've done
it. And two black secretaries of state.
There you go. Exactly.
One of them a woman.
Exactly. So that's my concern, right? That people will sit back and say, okay, we're finished. We don't have to do anything else.
Tick the box.
Yep. Tick the box off. We're done. And so we have to be deliberate about saying, we're just starting. We're still grooming the next black president, be it male, female, the next Hispanic president, the next Asian president. We're still grooming those people. And it shouldn't be a situation where it's just one in that history book. That's my concern.
I understand the concern. And there certainly are some white Americans who might like that to be the case. But I doubt it will be. Maybe Donald Trump's election as president is a predictable reaction to President Obama's tenure. And it may be equally predictable that an opposite reaction will come in response to the Trump era, from a generation of millennials who have grown up in a more integrated and tolerant world than the generation now in power. Certainly, Carla, the chairperson of ITSMF, sees reason to be hopeful.
We're seeing the younger folks coming in through our management academy, but we're doing all we can to keep up with their enthusiasm about what they can do, because they always believe that I can do anything. It's like, oh my gosh, yes, you can. You can. Slow down, hang on. And so it's a wonderful push-pull because we're learning a lot. This generation, they are very open, you know, open source. It's about reciprocity. It's about, well, I have this, what do you have? And the walls are low. It's a very exciting thing and it's something to admire. But I don't know what the future of that, the impact is. I think what happens with Black Lives Matter, the technology is allowing it to be seen now. It's always happened. It's hard to reconcile, but I have enormous hope. For one thing, this generation is a generation that's making it an issue and calling it out because they won't tolerate it anymore. Whereas I'm from the 60s, and so there's a generation of do it a certain way, right? So that you can have the American dream and you could be a part of it. Those rules are so, again, the walls are more distant and those rules are bent now to where that it exists, my husband will get pulled over and get stopped. That it exists is not the shocking part. It is tragic and we cry and sob over the things that happen because it feels so wrong. That's the hopeful part. As opposed to watching these things happen and then saying something like, well, what did he do? Or he should have just not spoken back. Those are the things that would make me much more pessimistic about the future. But that we're outraged is a very hopeful sign.
Back in that University of Michigan auditorium where I met Joshua Johnson,
the guy who grew up in Chicago's South Side. I also met Cheyenne Harris, who's 17, from a half-abandoned neighborhood in Detroit, went to a good high school from which almost everyone is going to college, but she's only the second person in her family after her sister to go to college. As a young African-American woman studying computer science, she's got a clear-eyed view of what she's going to have to do to shape her future.
With the issue of racism and stereotypes, I think it will get better in the future, but it won't ever end because we can't change people and how they think, like, at all. You know, if you were raised that way, then that's how you're going to be because of what you were instilled with. And you might teach your kids the same thing, you know? And so I believe I'll be faced with a lot of different forces against me because of the color of my skin and my gender. And as a minority and a female, I'll have to work twice as hard just to get where someone who isn't a minority is, you know, and to prove myself and my abilities.
Could you see yourself going back and, you know, sort of teaching some of what you've learned in places like the neighborhood where you grew up?
Definitely, because I would want to inspire others to go beyond what they see around them, because in the community, it's not the best at all. It's very bad. I want them to see that, hey, I made it out, so you can do the same thing.
President Obama has done his version of that. My hunch is, as this century moves forward, history will look kindly on his tenure and on his example. And Cheyenne is right. Racism and stereotypes are never entirely going to go away. Every society has them, even if they're different from place to place. At some point in the future, America will have a female president. And the world will wonder what took us so long. And if we work at it, and many groups and individuals will continue to work at it no matter who's in the White House, the arc of history will bend toward equal opportunity in Silicon Valley, in STEM research, in C-suites, and in general. And all our lives will be better for it. That's it for this time. Comments, suggestions, drop me a line at whocentury@gmail.com or on Twitter. I'm at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. If you like what you're hearing, rate us on iTunes. It helps others find the podcast. And while you're there, subscribe if you haven't already. You can also find us on most other podcast apps and on SoundCloud and Stitcher. The print version of this story and all previous episodes are on our webpage, pri.org/century. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Thanks for listening. Come back and join us next time.